Action. Are you ready, Alabama?
Hello? What, who's there? What's going on?
You're listening to Hour Number 2 in the Doghouse.
Whatever's happening here, just knock it off.
Call the big dog now at 866-485-9867.
These kids are weird, man. They're weird.
Live from the Big Dog Production Studios.
How you doing?
It's the Tom Abraham Show.
That might be listed in Revelations as the cause for the apocalypse.
Here he is, the head of the household, the Big Dog.
You're the smartest guy ever,
Tom Abraham.
You want me to do this crap?
I guess I'm on here. Am I on? Can somebody respond?
Welcome back, hour number 2 of the Tom Abraham Show here on a Football Friday in the Doghouse. And we do have a Friday Futurefecta for you today. Four random college football teams. We've already done the SEC, the ACC, and the Big Ten. So we just picked four teams to bring our college total to 16. Next week we'll do the AFC, and then we'll do the NFC. So we'll have six total categories for you. And you're playing for tickets to the Music City Bowl. So each week is a standalone deal. Plus we'll have a grand champion, whoever gets the most picks right all the way across the board. And I'm going to use my SEC insider, Josh Ward, who is very, very good on college football, all things college football. I'll use him as the guinea pig to tell you what the picks are, and we'll let his give us his opinions on those picks, and he joins us now on Woody Anderson Ford VIP Hotline. Josh, welcome in. How are you, man?
Tom, doing well. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you joining us. And so we got a little Futurefecta thing going on. We're using the regular season 12-game totals, and these are four teams outside of the SEC, ACC, and Big Ten. We did those in previous weeks. So I want to get your opinion on it. And we started with, and this is just for the 12-game regular season, we started with Oklahoma at 9.5. What do you think? Over or under 9.5 wins?
Oklahoma, over under 9.5. I'll go under. I'll go 9-3.
Really? Okay. All right. And I guess it comes down to that epic first game that they're going to have in the horseshoe against Ohio State. That's a game that's going to have ramifications nationally. I don't know that it eliminates anybody. I think it's kind of like the Alabama-Florida State game. Maybe you could even say like the Florida-Michigan game. I don't think you can get eliminated in one of those games, but it certainly puts your back against the wall.
Yeah, no, I would go Ohio State, but we do not overreact too much early on. The college football season, it goes by quickly, but it can also still be a long season. And a lot of what we think the impact of the first two, even 3 weeks of the season, oftentimes is not that. But that is a huge game, no doubt. But in the first couple of weeks do have big games that will impact what will happen based on conference play. I mean, there will be some teams that put themselves in very tricky positions based on how the first couple of weeks go. You know, the opening weekend, of course, Florida, Michigan, Alabama, Florida State, Auburn, Clemson, games like that. The losers in those games are not eliminated from what their goals are, but they are pushed up against a wall for sure.
Yeah. All right. What about Texas? They are at 7.5.
I'm going to go over with Texas. I think Texas is good enough to be a top 25 caliber team, and they're going to have to go 8-4, I'd say, for that to happen. So I will say Tom Herman goes in there, and their offense is good enough, and Texas will take advantage of some of the talent that's been recruited over the last few years and left behind for Tom Herman. So give me over on Texas.
All right. We're going to go USC at 9.5.
We'll go over, and part of that is the Sam Darnold vote. I still think Clay Helton has a lot to prove as a head coach, but if I'm Clay Helton, I'd like to prove it with that talent that he has at USC and with the quarterback that he has. I think he's the real deal. So look back at what they were last year. They don't beat Alabama, but things could have been different if Darnold was the guy from day one. Now he's the guy, and he's the leader of that team, at least that offense. So give me over.
All right. And then finally, Notre Dame. Notre Dame sitting at 7.5 coming off that 4-8 season.
really good number, I think, for Notre Dame. I'm going to go under at 7-5. And I went over their schedule earlier this week, and that Georgia game early is so important, and that will play a big role in the determination of this number. If Notre Dame wins that game, then I'm going to be wrong, and I think they'll go over. But I think Georgia's going to win that game. So give me, with still several really tough games for Notre Dame to go later in the season. So give me under at 7-5 for Notre Dame.
Is Brian Kelly all right at 7-5?
No. And at Notre Dame, I don't know that he should be. The expectations can get too high, but last season was dreadful, and 7-5 is not any good. So he's in big-time trouble at 7-5.
All right. Josh Ward with us, our SEC insider. All right, let's get to a couple of other topics. First of all, Nick Saban says that in response to Josh Rosen's comments that he doesn't think that it's any more demanding in college on a college athlete now than it was for him at Kent State back in the day. I don't know about that part of that comment. What do you think of that? I mean, does that seem logical? Now, they did have triple sessions back then. You'd run, and then you'd have doubles, but that was all before school started. Do you think that that's a logical comment, or do you think that maybe that's a little bit that it's more difficult on the student these days?
Well, and first of all, I should point out and admit, and it's probably obvious, I wasn't there then. So, I wasn't right. Covering it. I wasn't around it. So I don't know what he was going through, but I do know that today the schedule is 12 months out of the year almost. And when we talk about the 20-hour rule, we know that you're going way past 20 hours. Now, there are also a lot of benefits that come with it. I mean, the advancement in technology and the facilities and everything that athletes have access to that helps you get through the grind. And at big-time schools like in Alabama or like a UCLA, you have a lot of people in place to help you through some of those challenges. A lot of it is based on who you are and how able you are to manage everything. And I think that would apply to today or yesterday. But in terms of the school,
I think we lost him there for a second. Did we lose our boy Jeff?
That are watching what you're doing all the time, radio hosts, writers, social media, that has to be added into the equation as well.
Josh Ward with us. The other comment he had was regarding his quarterbacks who had earlier this week came out and said that, you know, they felt like they were treated unfairly or that it wasn't communicated properly and all those types of things. And he said that, look, I'm trying to give everybody a chance to win a position. It's my job to do a good job of making the best choice and decision for the team. And one of the most difficult things is sometimes not what everybody else would like it to be. You can't make everybody happy. Everybody wants to play. I have tremendous amount of respect for those guys as competitors. I don't know that was their complaint. I think their complaint was more about the way it was communicated to them that they were all going to have an opportunity to compete. But it's really a tough road to go down for players who have transferred out of the program for them to not look bad saying that.
Yeah, and with that situation, it could be that part of what the players are saying is correct, but that also Nick Saban got into the game and didn't like what he saw, wanted to see what Jalen Hurts could do, and fairly quickly things took off. He had that fumble early in the game, but it could be part of what they're saying is true and that communication could have been better. But, yeah, I don't know that the coach is going to tell them exactly what's going to happen because the coach right. doesn't know exactly what's going to happen, especially when you're trying to figure out things between three quarterbacks. Now, Nick Saban could have had an idea that I might go with Hurts more than I'm willing to lead on to these guys that are older than him. And in that case, you know, that's unfortunate. That's also just going to be reality that the players are not going to get all of that information. But I would remind them that things change when you get out on the field and coaches are going to alter what their decisions are. So I would say that there's probably some truth and they might have some points to it, but that's something that's an unfortunate part of it. The one thing I agree with was I didn't like the level that Saban criticized Blake Barnett with his decision. I think we talked about this at the time, Tom, that, you know, it's not ideal that Barnett took off in the middle of the season, but if he had waited it out through the end of the year at Alabama, one, there is a chance that something happens and Barnett gets to play again. It wouldn't have worked out that way in hindsight, but also that Barnett gets 5 years to play. And I don't like that Nick Saban essentially called Barnett a quitter because Barnett gets 5 years of eligibility. If he waited till the end of the season, that means he wouldn't have played last year. He wouldn't have played the year before, and he would be sitting out this year. So he would be leaving himself 2 years to play football. And if you're an athlete, I think you should maximize your opportunity. And with Barnett's choice at the time, that's what he did. So it's not ideal that he would leave in the middle of the season. It's unfortunate, but there are a lot of things that are unfortunate sports, and a lot of times there are advantages that coaches get. That's a case where the player took advantage of his own right.
Yes, but that's, I mean, it's a team, and you should be committed to the season at least. I didn't buy it. I mean, to me, it was you stay and compete. You know, I don't think it was over, although I think you could say that, you know, I think the seminal moment will always be the fact that Jalen Hurts goes back out after the strip sack fumble touchdown against Ole Miss. You know, the fact that they ran him back out there, that tells you something about how they felt about him and how the rest of the team felt about him. If there was a time he was going to get benched, that would have been it. And when they didn't do that, it appeared that he wasn't going to get benched at any point in time. But I still think you compete, you battle, you fight. You know, I think that's something that pays off down the road. Because otherwise, we're going to get into this a scenario here of, you know, this loophole is out there. Guys know it now. And there's going to be all kinds of guys making moves. And this is going to be, I think it's a little bit of a dangerous thing. I mean, I think there's a commitment. I appreciate what Sean White is doing. You know what I mean? Sean White's not going anywhere, I don't believe. I think he's committed to being an Auburn Tiger, and he understands his role, whether he's starting or not. You know, what's going to happen there in Tennessee? You know, whoever doesn't get that job, is one of those guys going to jump out of there? Is that why Butch Jones is talking about playing two guys instead of making maybe the right decision and pick one or the other, or is he just trying to appease guys? I think we can get into some dangerous waters.
Well, maybe so, but you know, there's the talk of just giving guys 5 years to play five. Maybe that would change things with this. Let's say Blake Barnett had done what you just said and he decided to fight through the end of the season, how would that look right now? Because he couldn't play football this year either. So I think in hindsight, looking back, for him, he made the right choice. And does that go against the team? Yeah, but he doesn't play at Alabama anymore. If he knew he was going to leave as well, think about that. If he knows that he's going to leave, or that he's 99% sure that he's going to leave, how great of a commitment is that to the team anyway if he stays around, just because it might make him look bad publicly? But also, how would that do for him right now? He'd be sitting out another season with 2 years of eligibility that will be remaining. So with a 5 years to play four role, you got to do everything I think that you can to maximize it. Other positions are different. Quarterback, there's one guy that realistically is going to go out on the field, and if you want to be that guy, you have to give yourself the best chance to get out there. And for Blake Barnett, leaving last year gave himself the best chance to play.
I understand that he's in a battle for the job at Arizona State.
Yeah, and you still have to go out and win it. I mean, there's no doubt, but he couldn't win it this year if he had stayed at Alabama last year.
Yeah. Josh Ward with us. By the way, I'm looking at a screenshot here of John Pennington's show, Sports Source, and it says here, this is at SEC Country Fine website, and it says here, John Pennington, host of Sports Source show each Sunday, took some time with Josh Ward to discuss the Vols' upcoming season. Did you shave your beard off? Because that's not Josh Ward to me in that picture here. I don't know. Have you seen this?
Well, that photo is probably, if it's the one that I saw earlier today, that's probably John Pennington talking to UT Athletic Director John Curry. So he is much more clean-shaven than me. My beard's a little out of control. I actually need to trim it up, but I can assure you the beard is still intact right now.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was, John Curry, who looks like he doesn't shave yet at all, maybe. It's just kind of weird. I didn't know that Pennington was doing that. He used to be a regular on the show back in the day, so it sounds like he's still bumping around in Knoxville, huh?
Yeah, no doubt. His TV show, which I'm lucky to be a part of every once in a while, and I'm going to be on there this Sunday. So I host the podcast for SEC Country each day, and here's a quick plug. I recommend people check it out. But so I had John on. He's celebrating his 15th anniversary show this Sunday, so we talked about where Butch Jones stands and questions, good and bad, with Tennessee's football team, because there are a lot right now that we're 2 weeks into camp, and I'm not sure there's a position group yet that we have a good feel for, except for, I would say, quarterback. I think quarterback might be the group we have the best hold on right now.
Yeah. I didn't know you were doing that podcast for SEC Country. How long have you been doing that?
started in the middle of last season, so we number each episode so fans can keep track. So today was the 222nd episode, so we're a ways in right now. We're rolling every day. It's a 5-day.
You could have said something. You could have told me. I'd give you a little love for that. I mean, you know, come on. That's a good thing.
You're probably right. That's a bad job by me. I've got in the Twitter bio. So as long as I'm plugging myself at Josh_Ward, but I post the link every day. So radio and podcast both. I've got them both rocking each day.
Am I not following you on Twitter? I thought I was following you on Twitter. Maybe I'm not seeing the tweets, but I was pretty sure that I was following you there. All right. Now, John Curry also said that it's crazy to have Butch Jones on any kind of a hot seat. He said that earlier this week. But that's what they always say when the guy's on a hot seat, isn't it?
It is. And John Curry also kind of leaned on something that Philip Fulmer had said last week.
There's Josh. He's back there. I don't know if you. I hope you don't do that podcast on that phone that you're on right now, because you seem to keep cutting out. I think it's that beard of yours. That bushy beard is covering up the mic on your phone or something, I think. That's what's happening there.
Well, yeah, that probably is it. I apologize.
Fulmer said if he doesn't win 9 or 10 games, people are saying if he doesn't win 9 or 10 games, you get rid of him. Are you kidding me? Have you all been paying attention the last 4 or 5 years? Nobody's saying you get rid of him if he wins 9 or 10 games. But if he wins 7, that's the issue. Now, Fulmer's sensitive about 9 or 10, because Fulmer was still winning 9 games a year when they got rid of him. But the thing is that if he's 7-5, are we going backwards?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing that going into Phil Fulmer's last season, he had a contract that said if he got to 8 wins, it automatically rolled over a year. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they went 5-7 in 2008, and Phil Fulmer was fired instead. But you're right. Nobody is saying if they go – well, not many people, very few are saying if they go 9-3 to get rid of Butch Jones. If he goes 9-3 or certainly 10-2, he's getting a raise and an extension after this coming season. The question is, I think to some, okay, 8-4, do you show signs that 2018 could be the year? 7-5 or worse, there could be some real, real concerns with Butch Jones. But why would John Curry get into that right now as well? This is his first football season as Tennessee's AD. You're 3 weeks from the start of the year. You're not gonna talk about the hot seat at all. But that was maybe John Curry's strongest endorsement to this point that he's given of Butch Jones. But he's the strongest part of it to me was when he said he thinks other people are, I'm paraphrasing, afraid of what or worried about what Butch Jones is building at Tennessee. I'm also not sure that's the case, but no. That's probably the strongest endorsement he gave to the job Butch Jones has done so far.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's concerned about what Butch Jones is doing there at Tennessee. But, there's a note in the story that says Jones inherited a program that was 2-14 against the SEC the two seasons before he took over. I didn't realize it had gotten that bad. But they were 2-14 against the SEC. What were they last year against the SEC? Weren't they like 3-5 or something against the SEC last year?
Tennessee was 4-4 last year in conference play, which tied with Kentucky, which is – now, I've pointed that out a few times in the offseason because there has been a lot of discussion of could Kentucky or South Carolina, but we heard a lot of could Kentucky finish in the top three, and a lot of Tennessee fans said, oh, no way, look at the history of Tennessee versus Kentucky, and Tennessee could still beat Kentucky head-to-head, and Kentucky could match or surpass Tennessee based on the scheduling. But last year, Tennessee and Kentucky tied for the same record in the SEC East. So Tennessee went 8-4 for a second straight year last year, but went 4-4 in conference play. 2 years ago, went 5-3 in the division. But this year, if Tennessee goes 8-4 and 4-4 in conference play, a lot of people think that'll happen. That would be exactly the same result as last year.
Well, now that you're doing the podcast at SEC Country, now I like that site even more. So that's a good thing. All right, now are they scrimmaging up there tomorrow? We got scrimmages all over the league tomorrow. Alabama will have their first scrimmage. You got Tennessee with their – or Auburn with their second scrimmage. I think Tennessee, this will be their second scrimmage, right?
Well, that's actually to be determined. Tennessee's out on the practice field right now. We got to see a few periods of practice just a few minutes ago. And after practice, Butch Jones is scheduled to meet with the media. And Tennessee's been dealing with some injuries on the offensive line. Now, they're getting guys back out on the field, but a few days ago, Butch Jones told us that depending on where the health is of the offensive line will determine whether they scrimmage. So they were scheduled to scrimmage tomorrow. Butch Jones said that might change. We'll find out officially later this evening. But they need to get guys healthier. They're on the way to that, but still a work in progress.
You see the amount of money Auburn's paying UMass to come down and play them in 2020? Just under $2 million now. I mean, my goodness gracious almighty, we talk about these pay-for-play games, and I remember when it was a big deal when you know, Southern Miss was getting $300,000 from Florida State, you know, to play them back in the day, and now it's $2 million. I mean, that's crazy.
Well, I think I heard that UMass wants to build lockers like Texas has, so maybe that's why they got a higher price. I think that's the plan.
Maybe that's what they're going to try. Maybe they're going to try and hire John Calipari to come back and coach the basketball or the football team this time. So maybe that'll be it. All right, man. Appreciate you as always. Good work. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll catch up next week.
You got it. Thank you, Tom.
There you go. Josh Ward, as everybody knows, does the podcast for SEC Country now. He's been doing it now for just a few weeks, 200 episodes. Who knew? I didn't know. You guys remember John Pennington? We used to have John Pennington all the time. I wonder if he's doing just Tennessee stuff. Pennington was really good, man, back in the day. Let's get a break. When we return, by the way, Brent Sobolewski will not be with us today because he had hernia surgery, and so he's laid up. Well, Sobo will be back at some point in time, but he's been laid up. But when we return, Matt Rudy will join us. We'll talk some PGA Championship with him. We'll give you an update on what's going on there and ask him why the PGA Championship looks like the U.S. Open. That's coming next right here at 730-1039.
Are you ready, Alabama? It's time to enter the doghouse.
By the way, Grumpy busted my chops earlier. Texted in, he said that I didn't play very much of the Auburn fight song, I guess, on a Football Friday, all the football music that you can stand. And he said, "Oh boy, you didn't play very much of that Auburn fight song. You jump in after five beats, and the morning show guys are right about you." And I'm like, I don't control the music. I have nothing to do with the music, okay?
And
I don't even remember when it played. I'm not even listening to the music half the time.
I'm pretty sure that was the bump before the update, and the update music comes out of the same pot. So whenever we come back from that break, I have to pot it down quick so I can get to my music so they don't overlap.
Oh,
so it had to do with
so
the update music, nothing to do with the Auburn music.
All right, so there you go. Who knew? Right? I don't know. All right, joining us now, Matt Rudy, Golf Digest. He doesn't have to deal with these kind of issues, right? Well, Yankees, Red Sox up there in New York City this weekend. He's up there with Golf Digest this week. Did not make the trek down to Charlotte, but he joins us on the Woody Anderson Ford VIP hotline. Matt, welcome in. How are you?
The easiest thing to do would just be to play the Michigan State fight, Tom. You'd solve that right there.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, that's the thing I've often said in the past. Should we not even play the fight song of Auburn or Alabama down here? Because it seems to create problems every time we do it. We try to be, you know, as balanced as possible, but it seems to always create a problem.
So. You would stand out though with the Spartan fight song. I'll be looking for that next time. Maybe when we talk in the fall.
There you go. That could work. All right. First things first, why does this PGA Championship look like the U.S. Open? The U.S. Open looked like the PGA with those scores, and the PGA looks like the U.S. Open.
And actually, that's a shame because I think the USGA does a pretty good job ruining the U.S. Open by making shots impossible to play out of the primary cutter off. And they actually backed the golf course down a little bit today, took a little of the yardage off because the greens, they have extremely fancy sub-air systems just like the folks at Augusta National do. So the greens are very firm. And if you miss at all off the tee, not only are you going to have a hard time getting to these greens, but if you do have to hit a shot that doesn't have any spin on it, you're going to have a heck of a time trying to keep the ball anywhere near the putting surface. And when you look at a guy like Kevin Kisner, I think it's apropos that he's leading because he's about as straight as it gets off the tee, and precision is his game. And since he got a little break on the yards backed off, he shot a good round today. And then that's going to, I think that's going to be the template for the rest of the weekend.
Yeah, I guess I should have qualified that. I didn't mean it as a compliment. You know, Kevin Kisner Andy North.
He's like, I did a photo shoot with him last week at the Bridgestone on Tuesday, and he hits it great. He's just not a bomber, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'm just saying he would be, if he were to go on and win. This is like Andy North winning a U.S. Open. You know, he's that kind of a Scott Simpson. You know, winning a U.S. Open. It would seem to be that way, but it'll be interesting to see how the course plays the rest of the way. Do you think this is what the PGA was looking for, to have something like this, and you know, where this will be a single digit deal at the end of the day? There might be a handful of guys under par.
I'm not sure if that's exactly what they're looking for. I think they were relieved that the weather didn't come through like they thought. There's supposed to be really bad thunderstorms over the first couple of days, and oftentimes at a major, when you get caught off guard with the weather and you don't get exactly what you thought, that can tend to lead to some scores that don't quite track with what people would predict, because there's a kind of a ritual, you know, a delicate kind of mating dance that goes in the course setup, because it's got to pair with what's going on with the weather. So I think what everybody would have predicted for this tournament would be that Rory McIlroy would have either played well or won it. He's played so well here over the years. And I think what we found is that the course has been changed so much since the tour events were there, with new holes and new greens, that anything we might have been able to predict about, you know, the way guys played there before is washed out. This is just kind of its own thing, which is interesting, but it makes it harder to predict what's going to happen over the weekend.
I'm mixed, and I've had it on in the studio, so I haven't been able to watch the way I'll be able to watch Saturday and Sunday, and especially with my wife being out of town. She's up in New York, actually. I'll be able to just sit there and really work this thing over pretty good. But I've got it on in the studio, so you don't kind of get that same, I'm not paying attention the way I would normally. But I don't know how I feel about 16, 17, and 18, the dreaded green mile, being like, forget making a move down the stretch. It's just it's like a negative thing. You know what I mean? It's just, can you make par down the stretch? If you par out, you know, you're probably going to win the tournament if you're one of those guys that's in contention, or you just don't blow up. On the other hand, it might be, you know, kind of exciting watching guys, you know, crash and burn on 16, 17, and 18. But I think I'd rather see, you know, two out of the three closing holes be holes that you could move on.
Well, you'd think that after however many years they've been playing the Masters at Augusta National, and we've had these great finishes on the back nine, that somebody would see that and say, you know what, there's a reason why that's the most popular tournament on TV and why people love to see what's going to happen. It's because of exactly what you're describing. People have a chance to make a birdie or make an eagle and make a move, and if they make a mistake, they have a chance to make a move in the opposite direction. So personally, I would always rather see what we see at Augusta and see what we saw with Henrik Stenson and Phil Mickelson last year at the British Open. Chances for guys to hit heroic shots and make birdies. That's my personal taste. I don't really fire for it when, you know, two guys are competing to try to shoot 71 and kind of ease it into the clubhouse.
And that's the way it'll be on Sunday. We're probably going to be watching, like we did in so many U.S. Opens, we're just going to be watching guys make 16 pars, and that's the guy that won the thing. And, you know, it's nice when there's some movement. You know, look, speaking of 16, at Augusta, I mean, you can't tell me. They pick the most favorable pin position on 16 because you have so many guys that are going to burn that cup coming off of that slope and have the possibility of a hole in one. And it's one of the most fun things to do is to watch 16 and see guys, you know, suck it back down off that hill and have it stop 4 inches from the hole or burn the cup or something like that. And they do that intentionally. If they wanted it to be brutal, they'd put it way up there in the back, you know, like in the back right where it's tough to get to. But they put it where there's a funnel, and it's very exciting because of that.
Sure. 13 is the same way. They put that pin up front, and they say, all right, if you're going to take the risk and bomb a tee shot down there, we're going to give you the chance to hit a shorter iron into the screen, but if you put a little too much spin on it, you could back it up in the water. And if you're a little too scared to go for the front pin and you're hit it over the back or you're way back there on the back of the green, you've got a scary two putt. And to me, that's the perfect combination of, you know, if you have the guts to go for it, you can make an eagle. And if you don't, and making a par there is like making a bogey. And I think that's the feel that you need to give tour players, where they get to holes and feel like they're giving shots away to the field. If they don't try to do something, they might not feel so comfortable doing. To me, if you're just trying to make conservative pars, tour players can do that. And what we're going to get, that's maybe not so much this weekend, but in general at U.S. Opens historically, it's, you know, how do we take risk out of it, make boring pars, and be the most boring player? And that might win you a U.S. Open, but it doesn't win you many new fans.
Yeah, Matt Rudy with us from Golf Digest. Bubba Watson shot 77 yesterday. He's now sitting right on the cut line, which is four over, because he is two under through 10 holes today. So he's got a good round going so far today. But what's up with Bubba, man? It seems like he's kind of fallen off the face of the earth since he won his second Masters.
The big rumor is that the ball deal he signed with Volvic, they make those multicolored balls that you see in the bowls and all the pro shops around, that he's not responding very well to the new ball. And with, you know, the way Bubba is, he's a particular sort of guy. I don't even know that it's really an indictment on the quality of the ball. It might be just that he thinks it's an indictment on the quality of the ball. It's hard to tell with him. He's a high-strung guy and an emotional guy, and that when he's on and he's feeling it, he can do things that nobody else on the tour can do. But on the other side of that, for example, if it's just a little bit wet out, or he just doesn't feel good about the course where he's playing, it's, you know, he's kind of notorious for being the guy that can't pull it together when there's some adversity like that, and you know, the grips are a little bit wet, or he can't quite feel the ball coming off the club because of the weather conditions. That's, you know, he's not a guy like Jordan Spieth, who's kind of known for pushing through adversity.
Yeah, no, I stopped calling him Bubba a couple of years ago because, and now I forgot what his real first name is, but I stopped calling him Bubba because if you're going to be a Bubba in the South, you can't be whining and pissing and moaning and crying about everything the way he does. I mean, that's just not a Bubba thing. You know what I mean? That's like, you know, I don't even want to throw a name on there because it would be too disparaging to say, but it's not, it's very un-Bubba-like, if you will, when you're constantly whining like that. John Rahm, a lot of people love John Rahm coming into this deal. He was one under par with a 70 in round one, blew up to 75 today. If we put too much on this guy, though, jumping all over him, and as he's the next great Euro, or maybe we got to pump the brakes a little bit.
I think the bar gets pretty high when you think of some of the young players and what they've been able to do. And you look at Jordan Spieth. Jordan Spieth is right around that age, a little younger, and you know, we're talking about Jordan Spieth trying to complete the career Grand Slam. That, when you think about that kind of an achievement, there's only a really small handful of guys at that age who've even been in that conversation. So to talk about a young guy in his first or second year on tour and to put major championship expectations on him, that's tough. That's a tough thing to carry around. But on the other hand, if you're going to be in that conversation and in that category, those expectations and the questions that come with that are part of the deal. I don't think it's any different than a first round draft pick in the NFL, you know, or coming up on football season. You know, they should be talking to different, you know, Leonard Fournette. They should be asking him, you know, if he thinks he can be the man. And if you're going to be the man, you better be able to handle what comes with it. So,
right.
I think the expectations are a little bit lofty and borderline unfair, but then again, that's part of the deal if you're going to take the big dollars.
Hideki Matsuyama is trying to beat a man. He just made his third straight birdie to get it to six under now. So Kisner in the clubhouse, 67-67 at eight under. You got Louis Oosthuizen. Jason Day is now four under. He's three under for the day. So we see him climbing up there. Ricky Fowler, a lot of people love Ricky in this tournament. He is a three under, so he's only five shots back or so. But, you know, where do you think the line is? We know the cut line is going to be four. But where do you think the line is of having a shot? Because it just doesn't seem to be anybody's going to go low. You know, 67 may be the best that you can do. You know, are we down to, you know, three under, you know, four or five shots of the lead and that's it? Or, you know, could Kisner and Matsuyama come back to the field and let everybody back in?
I think it's less about what the number is and more about how many people are between you and the lead. I think you can be five or six shots behind and be very legitimately in the tournament if there's just a couple people between you and the lead, because all it takes is, you know, for a guy or two to have a bad day. And as we've seen, that's pretty easy to find out there. But if you start getting the 20 or 25 or 30 guys back, you just need too many other players to do something wrong in conjunction with you doing something right to get back in it. So yeah. I think after today, if you're more than, say, 12 or 13 guys behind, it's awfully hard to win.
I was really loving Rory McIlroy and Dustin Johnson here because of the way this course is, a bomber's course. But, you know, McIlroy 72-72, so he'll be a non-factor, it looks like. And Dustin Johnson would have to get on his Honda here pretty quick. He's two over for the day and now one over for the tournament. And again, there's another guy carrying that number one tag around. Takes a little while to move up and down the world rankings. But he I thought after he won that major that, you know, he might take off like crazy. And now he's just kind of falling back to, you know, to where he was. And I don't think he's going to be number one for much longer.
It shows you what an amazing job Jordan Spieth has done with those expectations. Because as soon as you start winning tournaments like that and people keep calling into the media room on Tuesday to ask you questions and you get more requests for TV interviews and, you know, all the stuff that goes with being a high-profile player, some players need adjustment time to deal with those demands on their time and the change in expectation. Other players just take it right in stride. And you know, guys like Tiger, you know, what Tiger was able to do for a decade with the expectations that he had are it's just amazing. And Spieth, I think, is proving to be one of those guys. Rory McIlroy, I think, has been able to handle it pretty well. And, you know, when you think of it in the big picture over 5 years or 6 years, some guys it just takes a little bit more adjustment time.
Yeah, but see, Spieth hits a bad shot, and he's pissed. You know, I mean, he grinds hard. Dustin Johnson, he's got the hot wife. He's got all the money he possibly needs. I don't want to say he's a modern-day Fred Couples. I love Fred Couples, but Fred Couples did not maximize his talent. Fred Couples should have won six or seven times on the majors, and he should have had 20 wins on the tour, not 11 or whatever it ended up being. And that's kind of how I feel about Dustin Johnson. I feel like, you know, he enjoys golf and he enjoys being out there, but he's not really battling like, you know, like a guy that has that kind of a talent. He's going to be a guy that's not going to perform to his talent is how I feel.
I think you take the good with the bad when it comes with wiring. You know, the way Dustin Johnson is wired, I don't think he burns really hot about anything. And I think that certainly helped him at the U.S. Open. I can't think of any other player who could have gotten the shake that he got in terms of that weirdo, maybe it's a penalty or maybe it's not, ruling, right, and been able to just kind of go, well, man, I'm going to do my thing. And that's legitimately who he is. And I think that won him the U.S. Open because he legitimately didn't burn over it and it didn't tear him up while he was trying to play golf. On the other hand, it goes to exactly what you just described. If that's the way you're wired and you get some of that adversity that we were talking about with Bubba Watson, maybe you don't respond to it the way someone like Jordan Spieth does. And I think what makes Spieth so great, and we saw it at the British Open a couple weeks ago, is that he has a little bit of both in there. You know, he hits the ball off the planet, and it bounces on the driving range, and he's got this adversity to deal with, and he dealt with that too. I think the only thing Spieth doesn't have is raw horsepower. He just isn't as good at the top end as some of those other guys, so he has to be closer to his peak to do what he's doing, which actually makes it even more amazing that he continues to do it.
Matt Rudy with us, Golf Digest. All right, finally, before I let you go, look, I'm a huge traditionalist, big-time traditionalist in golfing and everything else, to be quite honest with you. But I want to get your thoughts on this switch of the PGA going to May, players going back to March, the FedEx Cup starting right after the British Open, and all of this being wrapped up by basically football season. I don't want to hear about the Olympics. This has nothing to do with the Olympics. This has to do with football and getting this thing done at the right time. Personally, I think it's genius. I think it's going to be an outstanding March, April, May, June, July. I'm stoked for it. But what were your thoughts about it? About moving the PGA to the to May?
They certainly want to get everything as far away from football season as they can. That's the first part about it, and I think the second part is they want to contain the majors in what is traditionally golf season. And I think everybody knows or believes that golf season starts in April when the Masters comes. Mm-hmm. And if you can have a murderer's row of big tournaments, you know, the players is the perfect lead in to the Masters, getting people ready. And then you've got the, you know, one major a month going from, you know, the, you know, April, May, June, July, I think that's a much better golf season, and it actually gives players an off season, which they don't have now, and it gives fans a time to kind of reset before the game matters again. Yeah. I think it's a no-brainer move, and it brings way more golf courses into reasonable play. I mean, they could have a major down where you are when it wouldn't be 7,000 degrees in the middle of the day. I mean, that's long-term, I think it brings more of the country into play, and I think that's a good thing too.
Yeah, and this has been kind of our major, you know what I mean? I mean, the folks in the South, we kind of feel like the PGA, this is one that they do bring down here, but you bring it down in August, and it's just ridiculous. I mean, the weather is just such a grind. And by the way, speaking of weather, they just blew the horn at Quail Hollow, and they're pulling the players off of the course now as they've got big-time thunderstorms coming in. And I could have told you that was going to happen because where we are, where I am, right on the Alabama-Tennessee border, it's been like a frog strangler over here. I mean, it's been crazy, and right. We're on that same plane, so I kind of felt like by this afternoon they may be in trouble over there, so that's what's happening there. All right, pick a winner for me. I hear you. Who's going to win this thing?
I think Kisner won. That'd be great for me because we just shot a big piece with him, and nice. My story would get a lot of play. But I think Kisner's cut in the same mold as Jimmy Walker, who won last year. And that's a guy who, you know, if he won, it wouldn't surprise me. I think he gets a lot of respect from players on tour. I think Ricky Fowler's going to win one of these one day. And I think if it's not Kevin Kisner, I think Ricky Fowler would be a good winner, and it would cause you have to look deep in the record books to find the last guy to win a major who made a triple in the same week. And that'd be pretty amazing to come back from that. So those are my two guys. I'm going to go Kisner or Ricky Fowler.
Matt, I appreciate you so much. Matt Rudy's been our guest from Golf Digest, and we'll. By the way, I think they're going to move the Ryder Cup at some point in time. This might open up moving the Ryder Cup back a month or so and getting it out of September football season too. But we'll see what happens with that. I appreciate you. We'll do it again, man.
You bet. Anytime. See ya.
All right. Thank you. All right. Let's get a break. We'll come back with an update from T-Mac. It's the Tom Abraham Show right here on 730-1039.
Now back to the big dog. Bark, bark.
Did that dude say the Braves are chasing down a wild card? Is that what he said? I think he said the Braves chased down the wild card. Maybe they're in the running for the 2018 wild card. Is that what they're chasing down?
It's called optimism.
I'm just saying it. Yeah, that's a little beyond optimistic. I'm just going to take a quick perusal here. The Braves are 12 games out of the wild card. Yeah, they're chasing it down. All right. Let's get an update with T-Mac. It's a Doghouse Sports Report.
Miami Marlins owner Jeffrey Loria has agreed to sell the Miami Marlins to a Derek Jeter-led group for $1.2 billion.
Whoa.
The sale will not become official until it receives approval from the MLB. That is expected sometime at the end of October. Ezekiel Elliott has been suspended for 6 games for his alleged role in a domestic violence case from last July. The NFL stated in their report that the advisor of Todd Jones, the NFL's special counsel for conduct, said they were of the view that there was substantial and persuasive evidence supporting a finding that Elliott engaged in physical violence against Ms. Thompson on multiple occasions during the week of July 16, 2016. Ezekiel Elliott will appeal the decision. The Buffalo Bills traded wide receiver Sammy Watkins to the Rams for cornerback E.J. Gaines and a 2018 second-round pick. They will fill that spot by trading cornerback Ronald Darby to the Eagles for Jordan Matthews and a third-round pick. The Bills now own 6 picks in the first 3 rounds of the 2018 NFL Draft. And finally, a little PGA Tour update for you. Kevin Kisner holds the lead after shooting back-to-back 67s, putting him at 8-under heading into the weekend. Ricky Fowler is... Ricky Fowler is 5 shots back of the lead at 3-under. Rory finishes 1-over, putting him at 2-over for the tournament. Jordan Spieth is 3-over through 10, while Justin Thomas is 3-under on the day through 7, putting him at 1-under for the tournament. Jason Duffner finishes 1-over on the day, which puts him at the projected cut of 4-over. Finally, Jason Day made a big move on the day, shooting 3-under through 9, which puts him at 4-under and 4 shots off the lead headed into the weekend. I'm Tony Mack, and that is your Doghouse Sports Report.
The breaking news for you. Jason Day made another birdie. He's now 4-under on the day and 5-under.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, just made another one since you started your report. And, yes, as you said, they are suspended now due to inclement weather. So we'll see when they'll be able to get going again. They've got, you know, it's one thing. They'll play in rain. I mean, you know, rain you can play in. It's just now they've got lightning, and the last place you want to be with a golf club in your hand is out there on a, you know, on a golf course when it's lightning, so you don't want to have that. All right, coming up at the top of the hour, Gary Davenport. This is a new voice that we haven't had before, filling in for Brent Sobolewski from the Bleacher Report. And I'm, you know, for Sobo, I don't know. We're going to see how good Davenport is. I hope Sobo isn't going to get Wally Pipped here. You know, I'm just saying. You know who Wally Pipp was, don't you, T-Mac?
I know you bring him up a lot.
Come on now. This is a reference you got to have. If you're going to have the McSlappy show every Saturday, you got to know who Wally Pipp is. You could Wally Pipp me someday. Wally Pipp was the first baseman that got sick, and Lou Gehrig went in for him. And Wally Pipp never played again because Lou Gehrig played the next 11 years in a row or whatever it was.
I was letting you take that story because you tell that story a bunch. So I mean, and no one tells a story better than you. So
I don't tell the same story over and over again, do I?
I don't do that.
Do I, Danny T?
But you've told the Wally Pipp story a few times.
Do I tend to say the same thing over and over and over again?
Certain things.
So Gary Davenport. Make sure you save his number now. I'm just saying, to kind of have some, you know, variety in there. We'll see if he's any good, but I mean,
for the sake of variety, absolutely saving his number. But to Wally Pipp, you know, Brent be a big deal. Brent's good, man.
Brent's really good. And Gary does fantasy football, and I'm still looking to see. I'm still not sure who I'm going to lock in as our regular fantasy guy. So keep that in mind too. All right, two down, two to go. We'll kick it off with Gary Davenport. Then comedian Justin McKinney is in. And we're going to Dallas at the top of the five with Kevin Turner to get thoughts on the Ezekiel Elliott deal. Lots to do yet here in the Tom Abraham Show. All right, 730-1039. Don't.
Sports Radio 730 and 1039, The Ump.